Well, today we're going to be in Isaiah 53. As we kick off the Easter season, I've titled this Against All Odds. We're going to be looking into Isaiah 53 and looking at a variety of prophecies that are told. And as I was thinking about the odds, right, the odds of Jesus fulfilling all the prophecies that he fulfilled, I also remembered what season that it is right now. And yes, we've just come out of March, but anyone else get excited for March Madness? The brackets? Yeah, some do, some don't. I personally love it. It is fantastic. It's an exciting time. But did you know there are 64 teams that play in the brackets in this tournament? And there has not been one time that we know of anyway that someone has been able to guess every single winner perfectly. There's never been a perfect bracket. Never. Now, there's been some that are close, but if you ever had a perfect bracket, do you know what the odds are of you getting a perfect bracket in the NCAA? It's 1 in 9.2 quintillion, okay? I had to look that up too, okay? Everyone else is like, what's a quintillion? I had to look it up too. You know what a quintillion is? It's one with 18 zeros behind it. One with 18 zeros. Now, if you were to maybe try to have better odds in other places, maybe you could guess the final four, like I did this year. The first time ever. It's fantastic. The final four, your chances are 1 in 82,000. And for you to guess that just the champion, that's a pretty good odds. There's 64 teams, so it's 1 in 64. It's pretty straightforward. Now, as fun as it is to talk about probabilities and mathematics and the odds of someone picking a champion or picking the absolute perfect bracket, which, again, has never been done, those odds are astounding, are they not? And the odds of Jesus fulfilling all the prophecies that Isaiah 53 talks about are also astounding. And we're going to look at Isaiah 53. Isaiah 53 actually goes all the way back into 52 as well. Really, it's a song of the suffering servant that starts in 52:13. And the odds of Jesus fulfilling all of these are astounding. In fact, commentators have said many wonderful, great things about Isaiah 53. Let's just consider Warren Wiersbe's comments on Isaiah 53. Warren Wiersbe says, Isaiah's greatest message is his word of salvation, announcing the coming of the Messiah, the servant of the Lord, who would die for sinners and one day return to earth to establish his glorious kingdom. The Messiah, Isaiah, was much more than a prophet. He was an evangelist who presented Jesus Christ and the good news of the gospel. Isaiah's servant song about Jesus is quoted or alluded to nearly 40 times in the New Testament. For Warren Wiersbe, Isaiah 53 is a really big deal. Albert Mohler also says something about Isaiah 53, something large and big and astounding. He says, the entire mission of the suffering servant begins with a promise direct from God himself. Because of God's promise, the work of the suffering servant will accomplish its purpose. It cannot fail. Over the next 3 weeks, we're going to be looking at these prophecies in Isaiah 53. And my prayer and my hope is that it postures us and it postures our heart for the season in which we remember our risen Savior. Not that we ever forget him all year long, but take advantage of this Easter season. Reflect on Isaiah 53 over these next 3 weeks. In fact, I want to read Isaiah 53. Let's look at the entire chapter in its context. And like I said, it really begins in 52, starting in verse 13. It's really kind of a sad thing that those who divided and kind of created the verses and the chapters, it's kind of sad that they created a chapter break at 53 because the suffering servant song really begins in 52:13. So I'm going to read that in its entirety, and we'll talk more about this one specific prophecy that we have. Look at verse 13. Behold, my servant shall act wisely, and he shall be high and lifted up, and shall be exalted. As many were astonished at you, his appearance was so marred beyond human semblance, and his form beyond that of the child of mankind. So shall he sprinkle many nations. Kings shall shut their mouths because of him. For that which has not been told them, they see, and that which they have not heard, they understand. Now 53:1. Who has believed what he has heard from us, and to whom has the arm of the Lord revealed? For he grew up before him like a young plant, and like a root out of the ground. He had no form or majesty that we should look at him, and no beauty that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and as one from whom men hid their face, he was despised, and we esteemed him not. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace, and with his wounds we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. Like a lamb that was led to the slaughter, and like a sheep that before his shears is silent, he opened not his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away, and as for his generation who considered that he was cut off out of the land of the living, stricken for the transgressions of my people. And they made his grave with the wicked, and with a rich man in his death, although he had done no violence, and there was no deceit in his mouth. Yet it was the will of the Lord to crush him. He has put him to grief. When his soul makes an offering for guilt, he shall see the offspring. He shall prolong his days. The will of the Lord shall prosper in his hand. Out of the anguish of his soul, he shall see and be satisfied. By his knowledge shall be the righteous one my servant, and many be to be accounted righteous, and he shall bear their iniquities. Therefore, I will divide him a portion with the many, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong, because he poured out his soul to death and was numbered with the transgressors. Yet he bore the sin of many and makes intercession for his transgressors. What an amazing piece of scripture. Isaiah there foretells of many prophecies of Jesus. And I wanted to make sure we read through the entire part, because I want you to capture all that we see here in the passage. And then the next 3 weeks, we won't be able to talk about every single one of them. But I encourage you, during your quiet times, during your reading times of Scripture, over the next 3 weeks, until we, on the other side of Easter, read this over and over and over. And you'll see what a beautiful piece that Isaiah wrote talking about our Savior. Speaking of fulfilling prophecies, Peter Stoner is a character in recent history. He actually wanted to kind of figure out the mathematical probability of Jesus fulfilling all of these prophecies, or at least fulfilling some. He was a Christian writer and chairman of departments of mathematics and astronomy at Pasadena City College. And he set out around 1950 or 1980, just a few years ago, he set out to establish what is the mathematical probability that Jesus could fulfill 8 prophecies, just 8. There are over 300 prophecies that Jesus could fulfill. But just to fulfill 8, it's one chance out of 1 to the 10 to the 17. You get it? 8. That's 17 zeros behind the 1. And that's just 8. That's not the 300 plus that he actually fulfills. Let me give you an analogy. Let's say I had a silver dollar, and I wanted to you to pick out this silver dollar out of a lot of silver dollars, and I've got a nice little silver dollar, and I'm going to write a red X on it because that's the one that you're going to find, and I have a few more silver dollars too, so I'm going to fill up this room with silver dollars, okay? I think that's a lot of silver dollars. That's a lot of silver dollars, but I got a few more. So I'm going to decide, let's fill up Gainesville, Texas with silver dollars, okay? Well, let's go a little further. Let's fill up Cook County. And there's a layer of silver dollars across all of Cook County, but it keeps going. Let's fill up North Texas. North Texas, where millions and millions of people live, let's fill it up with silver dollars so you can go find this one silver dollar I have in my hand. But we're still not to the probability of 8 prophecies. No, instead, Jesus fulfilling 8 prophecies is more like taking those silver dollars, covering the entire state of Texas, filling it up 2 feet deep of silver dollars, apparently so you can go swimming in it. 2 feet of silver dollars over the entire state of Texas. And I say, hey, I want you to go find this one. And I'm going to mark my red X on it. I'm going to take that silver dollar. I'm going to throw it out into the state of Texas. And then I'm going to shake it up a whole bunch. And then I'm going to say, you have one chance to reach your hand in there, take out the one I marked. That's the probability of Jesus fulfilling 8 prophecies, let alone 300 plus. In fact, Peter Stoner, in his great curiosity, he thought, how far can I go? And so he went 8, and then he went 10, and then he went 12. You know, he can continue to go on 10, 11, 12, 13. And he stopped, though. He stopped at 48 prophecies because he felt the number was simply a little bit too big to keep going. Do you know what the probability, mathematical probability of Jesus fulfilling over 300 prophecies, over, I mean, sorry, 48 prophecies, not the 300. The mathematical probability is 1 to the 10 to the 157. Do you know what that looks like? It looks like this. 1 out of all those zeros. And if I did my math right, I actually did do 157. And some of you are trying to count them right now, so stop it. I think it's right. What does this teach us? What does this show us about Jesus? It shows us this, that the person and work of Jesus is supernatural. It's a God thing. It has to be. Isaiah 53 has just a little over 20 prophecies for you to look at and to read about. And Peter Stoner and all this different talk about probabilities and mathematics reveals to us and show us that Jesus coming, living a sinless, perfect life, dying on the cross and raising 3 days later is a God thing. And that God thing calls for your obedience. It calls for you to believe in him. Because it is a supernatural thing that he did. And that's why we're going to look at one verse in 53, verse 7. Isaiah 53, verse 7. In fact, even in this one verse alone, there's a couple of prophecies we could talk about, but we are going to look at just one of them. Isaiah 53, 7 says this. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, talking about Jesus. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. like a lamb that was led to the slaughter. We'll actually look at that one next week, so make sure you come back. And like a lamb and like a sheep that before its shears is silent, so he opened not his mouth. When Scripture repeats itself, pay attention. Because what Isaiah is repeating here is the fact that he remains silent. Jesus remains silent. And today I want us to look at the trials that Jesus goes through. And I want us to take note and learn and observe and take in that silence. And we'll talk about what that silence means for us. Now, when it comes to the trials, we do have some lead up to the trials. Before the trials of Jesus, Jesus is having the Lord's Supper with him and his disciples up in the upper room. And even in that time, there is one who will betray him. Judas is there. Note that. Make sure you remember Judas is there with him in the Lord's Supper. But Jesus is talking about his body and his blood and how it's going to be offered up as a sacrifice for the forgiveness of sins. He's painting this picture for him and his disciples. And then after this, he goes on to the Garden of Gethsemane, where he prays, and his disciples are there, and then he takes a couple of his other disciples, and he asks them to pray, and they keep falling asleep, and he keeps coming back and saying, why are you falling asleep? But Jesus himself, in anguish, begins to pray, and pray so intensely that his sweat and his body, it's like there is blood coming out. That's how intense this is. And this leads all the way up to the first trial. This leads all the way up to the first trial that we see in John 18. John 18, starting in verse 12 and 14, we're going to see Annas. We're going to see the soldiers take him to Annas. Now, Annas is an interesting character. Annas used to be the high priest, okay? He's not the high priest anymore. Caiaphas is the high priest, but Annas is his dad. So even though he's not the high priest anymore, he still is very influential. He is still very powerful. Let's look at John 18, starting at verse 12. Remember, Jesus is there in the Garden of Eden, in the Garden of Gethsemane. And the soldiers come up, and here's what verse 12 says. So the band of soldiers and their captain and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him. First, they led him to who? To Annas. First, they led him to Annas, for he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas. Caiaphas is the high priest. That's going to be our second trial. But still in this first trial, it says, who was the high priest that year? Verse 14 goes on, it was Caiaphas who had advised the Jews that it would be expedient that one man should die for the people. Now, thinking here to Annas, if you're Jesus and you know that you're innocent and this band of soldiers comes and takes you, what would be your response? No way! Don't touch me! I've got my rights. By the way, he does have rights. He's a Roman citizen. And what does Jesus do in the text? Tells Peter to put away the sword. Don't stop chopping off ears. But Jesus' defense, there is none. Jesus allows himself to be taken. Isaiah 53, verse 7, he is silent as far as defense goes. That's trial number one. Look at trial number two with Caiaphas. Going to Annas here doesn't quite work out. Wasn't quite influential enough to get what they wanted. So now let's actually go to the real high priest, the son of Annas, which is Caiaphas. Now, this is about 2:30 in the morning, mind you. When the soldiers first come to him in the Garden of Gethsemane is about, you know, 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, and now the morning has continued to roll on, and 2:30 in the morning, Caiaphas is being woke up, and Caiaphas is the high priest, and he has to address this issue as well. And the question is Jesus going to speak up? Say something. You know you're innocent. You don't have to go through this. Let's see what happens with Caiaphas. Look at Mark 14, 60 through 62. And we have quite a few of these on the screens for us, too. If you want to thumb there, if you're really good at, you know, Bible drills, just sit there and shoot through the pages, go for it. Have fun. But Mark 14, 60 on the screen says this. And the high priest stood up in the midst and asked Jesus, "Have you no answer to make?" This is Caiaphas. This is the high priest. "Have you no answer to make? Aren't you going to give a defense?" He says, "What is it that these men testify against you?" Verse 61, but he what? He remained silent. Isaiah 53:7. And made no answer. Again, the high priest asked him, "Are you the Christ? Are you the Messiah? Are you the anointed one? Are you the one that Genesis talks about that is going to crush the head of the serpent? Are you the one that's going to deliver us from these Roman people? Are you that one? The Christ, the Son of the Blessed?" Now, right there, what does Jesus say? Because this is going to get interesting, because Jesus doesn't remain silent here. Look at verse 62. And Jesus said, "I am." Now, right there, don't you expect them to kind of fall back kind of with the soldiers earlier? But Jesus says, "I am. I am the Christ." By the way, if Jesus, and you know those critics that say Jesus never claims to be the Son, the Messiah, the Son of God, the Christ? I'm sorry, right there he does. "I am, and you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven." Now, this is interesting, isn't it? In my own studies on this over the few weeks here, I'm sitting here reading Isaiah 53 that he is silent, he is silent, he is silent. So I expect Jesus to say no words. But here Jesus says some words, doesn't he? See, the idea behind Isaiah 53:7 is that he gives no defense. That's how he is silent. He gives no defense. He gives no, "Hey, I'm innocent. Hey, you know, this is all a sham. I don't have to go through this. I'm a Roman citizen. Let me kind of just throw these guys under the bus because they're lying about me." You see, Jesus doesn't do that. He remains silent as to his defense. Why is that? He claims to be the Christ, the Son of Man, right here to Caiaphas. By the way, what's his job? It's the high priest. So of all the people to tell that to, that's a really important person to say that to. Nevertheless, he remains silent as to his innocence. He does not remain silent as to who he is. Third trial is this. He's been to Annas, he's been to Caiaphas. Now he goes to what I called an official council in Mark 15:1. Mark 15, 1, it says, "And as soon as it was morning." Okay, so when is morning? It's at 6 a.m., okay? So 2:30, now we're all the way up to 6 a.m. "And as soon as it was morning, the chief priest held a consultation." Well, who's the chief priest? That's still Caiaphas. So that's why I've called this meeting here an official council. Because I feel like the earlier one was a little bit unofficial. It's just bringing Jesus with all these soldiers bound to Caiaphas, for Caiaphas to kind of give a, "Hey, if you could just kind of do this one on the side," kind of thing. This doesn't have to be an official thing, but he waits. So now we have what we would look at as more of a official council. The text goes on. Chief priests held a consultation with who? With the elders and the scribes and the whole council, and they bound Jesus and led him away and delivered him over to Pilate. Now, that's a really short verse for just one specific trial. Commentators suggest, by the way, this is the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin was full of chief priests, scribes, and elders. That's most likely what's happening here. But look at the verse. As soon as it was morning, Jesus is now in a more official way, right? A more official setting, being accused of the things that he has not done. Jesus you've seen Anas, all right, just an influential person, and you could have said, time out, wait a minute, this is wrong, I'm going home. But you don't, you remain silent. Jesus, you've, in the dark and in the dead of night, you've gone to see Caiaphas, the high priest. And Jesus, right there, you could have said, this is a sham, I'm innocent, but you don't. You remain silent. And now the sun is up. And now this is looking a lot more official. Jesus, this is the third trial. Don't you think you should say something? There's nothing. He's silent because he's giving no defense because he knows where it's going to lead. Let's look at the fourth trial. Again, this official council, the Sanhedrin, they push him off to who? Pilate. Okay? They push him off to Pilate, the Roman ruler. Pilate is an interesting character. He oversaw law and order in the region. He collected taxes and managed the finances. But Pilate, in all that he can do, what is interesting about him is he has the power to execute criminals. Keep that in the back of your mind. He has the power to execute criminals. So that is where the people are taking him now. This fourth trial. Let's look at the fourth trial. Let's see how the fourth trial ends up. Let's see if Jesus will start saying something. Because now you're in front of a heavy hitter. Your life can be taken now. You're in front of the executioner. Look at Mark 15, 2 through 5. We just read chapter verse 1. This goes quickly into this one. And Pilate asked him, are you the king of the Jews? And he answered him, you have said so. And the chief priests accused him of many things. And verse 4, and Pilate asked him, have you no answer to make? See, even Pilate gets it. Why aren't you saying something, Jesus? So how many charges they bring against you? See how many charges they bring against you. But Jesus made no further answer, so that Pilate was amazed. Jesus remains silent in front of the very one that could bring about execution to him. Why, Jesus? Why do you give no defense? You have all the opportunity in the world. I mean, think about this. If this was me and you, I know I could ask in a room, have you ever been arrested, kind of a thing, you know? But I won't. But you can imagine if you have, or you can imagine yourself if you haven't. Anyone that's arrested, what's the first thing that they claim? I'm innocent. I haven't done this. Even if you have, like, you're still going to lie about it because you desire self-preservation. You don't want to go down. No one who is in this kind of a setting, no one sits there and says, I want to die. All of us say, what do we say? I don't want to die. I don't want to go down this path. That's the human nature in us. I don't want to die. Jesus remains silent in front of the executioner. Trial number 5. Pilate sees him as being innocent. So Pilate sends him on to Herod. Now, who is Herod? Herod is a local ruler under Roman authority. He has some abilities and some powers. He handles local affairs and maintains loyalty to Rome. And Herod is an interesting one, too, because he is considered a Jewish ruler, not because he's ethnically Jewish. He's not a Jew in that sense, but him and his family did take on and were converted into Judaism. They dedicated themselves to whether it was a political thing or not, they dedicated their lives to actually being a part of all of the different Jewish aspects of life. It was at least to maintain some legitimacy. So he has converted to Judaism himself, him and his family. Whether that was a true thing or a political thing, either way, the people at the time see him as a client king to the Jews. So that's why Pilate sends him there. He says, you've got more connection here with this so-called, he would say, this so-called Jewish Messiah. So why don't we let Herod take care of it? And so he sends them on to Herod. This is in Luke 23, 7 through 9. Now, I'm only putting 7 through 9 on there, but I also wanted to start with verse 4. So Isaiah 23, starting at verse 4, it says, then Pilate said to the chief priests and the crowds, I find no guilt in this man. So we're backtracking a little. This is Herod, right? But they were urgent, saying, he stirs up the people, teaching throughout all Judea and Galilee, even to this place. Now, that's really important. Why does he mention Judea and Galilee? That's where Herod has authority. All right? Pilate has authority in Jerusalem, and that's where they are. But Herod, he's got authority up north. Verse 6, when Pilate heard this, he asked whether the man was a Galilean. He's asking them whether or not the man is a Galilean, because then he would have some authority in the matter. Verse 7, this is where we can pick up on the screens. And when he learned that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him over. It says Pilate sending him over to Herod, who was himself in Jerusalem at that time. Remember, this is Passover week. This is a week of celebration. This is Passion Week. Verse 8, when Herod saw Jesus, he was very glad, for he had long desired to see him, because he had heard about him, and he was hoping to see some sign done by him. He questioned him at some length, but he made no answer. He makes no answer. Again. He's in front of Herod. And Herod is actually glad to see him, isn't he? Now, I think Herod has some kind of morbid interest in wanting to learn about this Jesus person because, oh, I've heard about Jesus. Maybe he'll do a miracle for me. Maybe he'll be my entertainment for the evening. Maybe that's why he wants to see him. I don't know. But of all the people Jesus sees, I mean, you've got some credit, right, with this one. Caiaphas was the high priest. The high priest was always staying in Jerusalem. You probably don't have credit with him. Annas was always in Jerusalem. You don't have credit with him. This official council, you're far from home. You're in Jerusalem. You're not up in Galilee. But Pilate, that's someone you think, hey, this is the kind of relationship that I might could, leverage in my favor. And what does Jesus do? He makes no answer. Isaiah 53:7, he is silent once again. So what is Herod to do? Herod kind of just washes his hands of this and says, you know what? I think he's innocent too. I'm sending him back to Pilate. That's our trial six. Trial six. He goes back to Pilate, the Roman ruler. Seeing Pilate again. And this is where it's the most dangerous because we remember that Pilate has the ability to execute capital punishment. Look at verse 24, or chapter 24 in Luke, verse 18 through 24. But they all cried out together, away with this man, and release to us Barnabas. Now, we don't have time today to go into the story of Barnabas, but Barnabas was a really bad guy. Verse 19, a man who had been thrown into prison for an insurrection started in the city and for murder. Pilate addressed them once more, desiring to release Jesus. Look at that. Pilate desires to release Jesus. But they kept shouting, crucify him. A third time he said to them, why? What evil has he done? I have found in him no guilt deserving death. I will therefore punish and release him. I mean, Pilate's trying to give them, a little bit of credit. Like, hey, listen, he's done nothing wrong. I think he's innocent. Let me just beat him up for you. And so he looks really bad. But the people continue to cry. Look at verse 23. But they were urgent, demanding the loud cries that he should be what? Crucified. That he should be executed by the state because he is a criminal in their minds. and their voices prevailed. Verse 24, so Pilate decided that their demand should be granted, and then Jesus goes to the cross. What defense does Jesus give? What defense does Jesus give here with his final interaction with Pilate? I mean, can you imagine being there? And if in my human nature, if this was me, and Pilate is sitting there going, I find him innocent, I would be like, I agree with him. Like, I'm going to say something. What does he do? He's silent. He is silent. He is silent. This is what Isaiah 53:7 is all about, is that Jesus remains silent. He does not give a defense through all of these trials. Why? I have three truths for us to walk away with today. The silence through the trials. Number one is this. Jesus gives no defense, even though he is innocent. Jesus gives no defense, even though he is innocent. We see this throughout the New Testament. Consider Hebrews 4:15. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weakness, but one who has been tempted in every way as we are, yet without sin. He is innocent. Peter saw this as well. 1 Peter 2:22. He did not commit sin, and no deceit was found in his mouth. His silence does so much for us because Jesus gives no defense. And I thought about making this, what I'm about to say, I thought about making this like the title of the whole thing. I feel like Jesus gives no defense so that me and you could have a defense. Because when we stand at the judgment seat, when we stand and we go to the throne, and when the accuser, Satan himself, stands at the side, and he accuses. He says, Kevin, you've done this wrong. You've done that wrong. You think like this. You do like this. You are all the things that you are not. You are not holy. You are not good. And I have no defense. But Jesus remains silent so that I could have a defense. Because, yeah, all the accusations you give to me are true, but I know Jesus. And if what he says is true, and if his grace is true, and his mercy is true, and his forgiveness is true, because Jesus was silent, and he goes to the cross so that my sins can be forgiven. He gives no defense so that we can have one. Secondly, no defense results in death. It's a simple observation. For Jesus, no defense results in death. And this is why it's really good to read Psalm 57 or 53, verse 7. It's really good for us to think about and meditate about the season, because as you think about Jesus going to the cross, that's what Passion Week points toward. It points toward Jesus going to the cross and dying for our sins. And Easter Day, we celebrate the resurrection because we have life in his resurrection. But don't forget the road that was traveled. Jesus gives no defense, and it will result in his death. Matthew 26, 53 and 54, it says, or do you think that I cannot call on my Father, and he will provide me here and now with more than 12 legions of angels? Jesus remained silent. Do you think he couldn't have fixed the situation? You think he couldn't have dealt with Caiaphas, with Herod, with Pilate? You think he couldn't have dealt with them? He can call 12 legions of angels. But then the text goes on and says, how then would the scriptures be fulfilled that say it must happen this way? Like the Mandalorian, this is the way. Matthew 16, 21, from then on, Jesus began to point out to his disciples that it was necessary for him to go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders, chief priests, and scribes, be killed and raised on the third day. In Matthew 16, 21, he literally tells his disciples of what's coming. He gives no defense, which this will result in death. But thirdly, his silence teaches us this. His death captures forgiveness. forgiveness for us. His death captures forgiveness for us. Even though he was reviled, he did not return revile. Even though he suffered, he did not threaten back. 1 Peter 2:23, he continued entrusting himself to him who judges justly. You see, Jesus can remain silent through this because he trusts his Father. And he trusts his Father who has a plan. 2 Corinthians 5:21, he made the one who did not know sin to be sin for us, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. His death captures forgiveness for us. Now, what's his death and silence got to do with anything? If Jesus doesn't remain silent, he doesn't go to the cross. If Jesus doesn't remain silent, if Jesus gives a defense at any point in any of these trials, if Jesus gives a defense and says, hold up, time out, okay, this ain't happening. I'm going back home to my friends, my brothers, my sisters, and my mom, and I'm going back to live the rest of my life. If Jesus gives a defense, he doesn't go to the cross. So I think in his silence, in his non-defense, he's saying yes to the forgiveness for us. John Calvin, the great reformer, put it this way. He says, in order to interpose between us and God's judgment, Christ chose to be condemned before an earthly tribunal that we might be acquitted before the heavenly judgment seat of God. It goes back to the idea that he gave no defense so that we could be defended. It's a beautiful thing. This is my final truth today, is this. He was silent so that you could be forgiven. He was silent so you could be forgiven. And if you have not trusted in Jesus, think about the problem. If you doubt that Jesus is who he says he is, think about how we started. Think about the mathematical probability that Jesus could fulfill just 8 prophecies, yet he fulfills over 300. He was silent so that you could be forgiven. If you have not received his forgiveness, please do so today. Just close your eyes, bow your head and say, Jesus, I trust in you. Say, Jesus, I surrender all. I let go of all that I have, all of my accomplishments, all that I could ever do, and all that I am, and all I want to do is know you and worship you and tell others of you. And if the Spirit is drawing you into that relationship, say yes today and receive his forgiveness.